21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Zoe Hieronymus.
It's all about soul. It's all about faith and a deeper devotion. It's all about soul. Cause under love is a stronger emotion. She's got.
Welcome to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Zohara Hieronymus. Laura Portner is our executive producer, and Kristen Hagrick runs our board. Joining us this hour is Tom Zolper, Maryland Communications Coordinator for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, whose mission is saving the Chesapeake Bay through education, advocacy, litigation, and restoration. And this portion of our program will focus on some local Maryland and regional issues that affect many generations of people, wildlife, and the ecosystem. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Hi, Zoe. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. You know, I try every year, every couple of years, to do an update with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation because you all have been such an important enabler of positive ecological and community changes. Can you tell us a little bit about the history going back to 1964?
Yeah, we started... can you hear me okay?
Yes, we do.
All right. Yeah, we started as just a couple of people.
Tom, we're going to have to take a quick break. We're having a problem here, and we won't be able to hear each other. So
all
if
right.
you can hold on, we're going to take a very short break and try to get this engineering problem solved. All right, thank you. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I think we got that all worked out. Tom Zolper is our guest. He's the Maryland Communications Coordinator for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. And I asked him to tell us a little bit about the very long history the Chesapeake Bay Foundation has enjoyed, starting way back in 1964. Are you there, Tom?
I am, Zoe, yes.
Very good.
So, sure, it was actually started by businessmen, which some people are surprised. These are guys who were hunters and fishermen, sailors, and they noticed that the water was getting dirty, and they went to, and actually a Republican congressman from the time, Rogers Morton from the Eastern Shore, and he said, you know, government can't do it all. You need to start organizing, you know, private citizens and get the private sector involved. And at first, our thrust was really educating kids. We had a tiny little education program with a couple of canoes nearby Meredith Creek. And then at some point, we realized, you know, the hands-on stuff is important. We'll keep doing that. But we need to really talk to politicians and get them knowledgeable. And so, you know, we developed into a group that does not only environmental education, hands-on restoration, but what we call advocacy, getting into the state capitals and down to Washington to really advocate for change in laws. So we've been sort of growing from, I think we were something like three people in 1970 to about maybe 150 staff now and 200,000 members.
Just wonderful.
Yeah.
So let's take a look at some of the issues that you all are working on right now. And I know one of them is the Conowingo Dam relicensing. So tell us what that's about.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much your listeners may know about this big dam that's up on the Susquehanna River. It's about 10 miles from the mouth of the river, you know, where it empties into the Chesapeake. And it's been there for decades and decades. And it's coming up for what's called relicensing. So the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission relicenses this facility every couple of decades. And it's a very involved process. And one of the things they look at is the environmental impact of that dam. And an issue that they're looking at this year is for decades now, you've had dirt, what we call sediment, coming down the Susquehanna River from Pennsylvania, from New York State, and it gets trapped behind that big dam. And in a way, that's a great thing for the Chesapeake Bay because that dirt can be really harmful. But the trouble is it's now filled up that big reservoir behind the dam, and there's some studies that show that especially in big storms like Tropical Storm Lee a couple years ago, it actually is spilling over the dam. It's so full with this dirt, this mud. And that's potentially a huge problem. So luckily this relicensing is going to look at solutions for that. Dredging may be part of it, but it's extremely expensive. So they're looking at various options for solving that. And we, as a regional organization, we have filed to intervene, as they call it. In other words, to have a formal place at the negotiating table to make sure that whatever solution they arrive at is really adequate to protect the bay, so that this mud and dirt isn't just pouring over the dam in the future. And that, you know, will probably take much of the next year.
And then, of course, so many of the issues are explicitly water issues. And another one I know is that you all are working on, and it comes up every once in a while, is the huge amount of water runoff that we have in Maryland. And I know that's very controversial, these storm water fees or mm-hmm. rain tax. Talk
right.
to us a bit about this.
Yeah, most people aren't aware that there's this water pollution source that the technical people call stormwater. What happens is rain, innocent rain, when it comes down, once it washes over your city streets, your suburban streets and neighborhoods, picks up all kinds of trash and filth. Could be dog waste, could be fertilizer from your lawn, any number of things, oil from the road. And it goes more or less straight into local creeks. And it's been an issue that most cities and suburbs and counties have put some effort into slowing down, but not much. I mean, you know, we've been focusing on the big things, the farmers and the pollution that they contribute, and the sewage plants, obviously. But this is this sort of third rail, and nobody's paid much attention to it. And we've noticed that it's the only source that's actually getting worse. We've gotten control of some of these other big pollution sources to the bay, but lo and behold, here's this other problem that's getting worse. And in fact, in the county where I live, Anne Arundel County, the health department warns you not to go into the water or even come in contact with the water for 48 hours after a rainstorm of a half inch or more, which is not a really big, it's a summer thunderstorm. And that's because that rain, that runoff, or that stormwater has picked up so much stuff, including a lot of harmful bacteria, that, you know, your kids are susceptible to getting stomach aches or worse if they go in the water. And that's pretty bad. Moms hear that. Dads hear that. And they say, what?
Because every once in a while, like on the Magathy River, there'll be some warnings not to go on such and such a beach. Mm-hmm. But I've noticed over the last 12 years that I've paid attention to the Magathy, it's like, what lives in there anymore? There's so much nitrogen.
Right. It's almost, you're almost amazed that anything survives, and nature is pretty resilient. You're right. Absolutely.
Well, there was a state law, right, to require 9 of the large Maryland counties and Baltimore City to collect a fee to help reduce this pollution runoff. What happened with that? Is that something that we are doing or the counties are doing?
Well, let me back up just a bit, and you're absolutely right. But these 9 big counties, these are the most populated counties, plus the city, they're already under a requirement, a federal requirement. It's called a permit that they have to meet to reduce this kind of pollution. So it's really not new, but we've noticed, Maryland has noticed, that there's not a whole lot being done in those areas. About 2 years ago, the state legislature said, well, we'll give you really tens of millions of dollars to start working on this, but you guys have to help as well. You have to pony up as well. So they arrived at this solution after a lot of hearing and debate. We're going to pass a law that requires these 10 jurisdictions to raise some kind of fee. But we're going to allow you to set the fee, and we're going to let you decide how to collect it, which is what the counties wanted. So you had this sort of mixed bag of you have to, but you have a lot of flexibility. And as a result, over this past couple of months, these counties have arrived at very different kind of fees, everywhere from 1 penny per year in Frederick County per household to, you know, over $100 in some. And that surprised a lot of people. Like, why is the next county charging so much more than me or so much less than me? There's been a lot of confusion about this. Where did this come from? Why are we taxing the rain? Well, of course, we're not taxing the rain. It's a fee that is dedicated only to reducing this particular kind of pollution that I talked about. And it's really a local decision. It's up to these local counties to decide whether they want to charge you by how much pavement you have, you know, how big your driveway is, or they just want to charge one fee to both you and the giant mall. You know, it's really up to the county. And,
you know, it interests me because when I think about the way in which these enormous corporations who are major polluters have gone around the Clean Air and Clean Water Act, why all of a sudden a rain tax when we can't even get adherence? And, you know, it always interests me that the householders held to standards that the bigger corporations aren't, or that the state might not be, or that even the federal government isn't. And we have such enormous polluters, including the military, including the airports, et cetera, you know, that affect our water here in Maryland. But it's the householder that keeps being asked to ante up. Talk to us a little bit about that. That's this bigger picture that's going on in our state.
So did you want to focus on any of those other polluters or?
Well, you can. I mean, you know, you're certainly familiar with what feeds into our bay, and it's not just what's in the state of Maryland.
Yeah.
But there's some serious problems that aren't necessarily a householder's doing.
Certainly, that's true. And I don't think what we've said is that everybody has to play a part, whether you are a householder or whether you are a corporation. And I asked you if there was anybody you wanted to focus on, because, you know, I hope there's not somebody that we're given a, you know, get out of jail free card to. I mean, we're trying to slow the pollution wherever it's coming from. In this bill that we just talked about 2 years ago, the state tried to exempt itself from. It did successfully exempt its state properties from this fee.
How interesting.
Yeah.
It's like the state is hell.
Yeah.
But that's what I mean. But that's what we see nationwide.
Right.
I mean, I've been working with so many other, you know, people against fracking and against GMOs. And you look at the information, and the information's so clear how bad these things are. And yet you get state regulators and federal regulators going, oh, this looks like the best pollution we can, you know, tell everybody is good for you.
Yeah. I mean, they had, you know, their own argument. They said, well, I mean, it's going to be coming out of the taxpayer's pocket anyway. If you put a fee on a state property, well, who's going to pay it eventually? The taxpayer.
It's the citizen.
And I guess, you know, you can make the same argument for a military establishment or whatever. But no, we came back the next year and the legislature said, no, and you can't exempt state property no more than, you know, even some of the large nonprofits. There was quite a reaction. You know, obviously, if you're a small church, that can be an issue, but there's Baltimore City has, you know, huge John Hopkins and some huge nonprofits, and, you know, why shouldn't they contribute to this? So we're trying to get everybody to play a part.
One would think that's only reasonable.
Yeah,
and what would be expected, seeing Hopkins is the single largest employer in Baltimore City.
Sure.
You know, but you all have a relatively new plan, I've been told, for finishing, for the ongoing challenge of restoring the bay to health.
Yes, and I like your word finishing, actually, because few people are aware that we've actually done, all of us have done a pretty decent job of reducing the pollution that goes into the bay. Bay-wide, we've sort of gotten about halfway to the goals that the scientists tell us we need to get to have a clean bay. That's pretty good. The trouble is the ecosystem is so degraded that it just doesn't bounce right back, you know. But scientists say, okay, you're about halfway there. If you can reduce pollution by about another 24%, and we're talking nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment, you're going to have this giant ecosystem really rebound. So the trouble is we've sort of gotten a lot of the lower, you know, low-hanging fruit. It's starting to get expensive to get the rest of the pollution. So it's, the whole sort of restoration effort is bogged down. Political will has, you know, decreased.
What's in the way? I mean, what are the particulars that stand?
Money is a big issue, you know. I mean,
meaning, what do you mean? The funding that it would require to carry out what's necessary?
I mean, to go into a sewage plant, for instance, and reduce. Sewage plants were originally made just to take out the harmful bacteria, you know, of the human waste. And then in Maryland, maybe, you know, 8-10 years ago, we said, well, we have to start reducing the nitrogen. Because in our waste, there's nitrogen, and then it was passing right through the plant and into the creeks. So that's been another, there's been two stages of upgrades of those plants, very expensive, tens of millions of dollars, you know, oftentimes for even small plants. So that's expensive. Farmers have their own expenses, reducing, you know, pollution on their farms. They've gotten a lot of public subsidies.
But it's interesting, before you pass that point, because I know you all make an issue of working with livestock farmers, like in Western Maryland, and encouraging them to go back to farming the old-fashioned way, which is raising animals on pasture rather than in confined areas. And how does that help?
It helps a lot. I mean, not only in terms of reducing the, you know, somehow, I don't know, in our society, in our farming society, we have it upside down. We've gone from what our great-grandfathers did, raising the cattle out on a pasture, to now raising them in this confined area. In some ways, it's cheaper. You buy your corn, or maybe you raise some of your corn. You keep your cows in this confined area. They're not really all that healthy. It's difficult to figure out what to do with all this manure that's piling up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're out on the pasture, it would fall, and it would have time to naturally be filtered by the vegetation. Anyway, but it doesn't make any sense. And I think even farmers are realizing that economically it doesn't make sense. We've proved to them that, you know, getting them back on the pasture, you're going to get rid of your big, heavy machinery. You're going to reduce your fuel costs. Your animals are going to be healthier. But farmers, like all of us, I guess they're kind of slow to change.
We went through such a heavy industrialization of the farming process, and whether it's the poison fed into the animal with growth hormone or the poisons they spray on the field and now the genetically modified organisms. You know, when you all look at, I mean, there's so many issues that are connected to healthy water.
Right.
And there isn't an issue that isn't, actually, and particularly for a state like Maryland with its inland estuary. So when you look at these issues, for instance, I just want to ask you about fracking, if the Chesapeake Bay Foundation is taking a position on that.
Yeah, before I answer that fracking, though, can I just, I think I failed to complete the question you asked before. Like, what is this plan to finish the job? So I'll try to be succinct.
Sure.
One half of it is scientists gave this very scientific sort of, here's the amount of pollution you have to reduce further than where you are right now. And then all the states that are in the watershed and the District of Columbia said...
So that's six of them, six states?
Six states, yep. All right, we will actually agree to reduce that amount. And for the first time in the history of this whole effort, there was accountability. Mm-hmm. EPA said, all right, we're going to hold you accountable. We're going to take away funding. Maybe withhold permits if you don't do this. We're going to require you every 2 years to actually report your progress so we can, there's a transparency to this whole thing. So that is supposed to all happen by no later than 2025. Like everything that would be required to get this bay finally clean is supposed to be in place by 2025. That's not that far from now.
No, and particularly if you account for the warming trends that we're in right now, it's not a likely goal to be reached. I mean, there's going to be so many new problems.
Exactly. Anyway, fracking. I mean, our position has been there has to be the public has to be assured that this is going to be safe. And in Maryland, that has meant a multi-year study that the governor committed to really get to the bottom of, you know, does it get into drinking water? What are the safeguards required to, you know, if this thing were to be done safely, can it be done safely? And, you know, we've tried to help get some money for that funding. We've tried to, you know, make sure that it's going to be an adequate study. But that's sort of where we are. We realize that this may be an issue that, you know, there's such a need for energy now, alternative energy. If it can be done right, we're not going to stand in the way of it, but we're certainly...
I have never seen any location it's been done that it can be done safely, particularly on the scale that they're now doing it with the new technologies and chemicals that they're using. I just think that's just a lot of words that get put out there by governments who are looking to think that this is going to be some energy solution, but it's not.
Yeah.
Rather than investing in really, you know, spearheading solar or hydrothermal or something else, wind, anything. I mean, I just, it's like we keep going backwards and then we pollute our wells and then we pollute the aquifers and here you're worried about the bay and we can't even get the EPA to enforce the Clean Air and Clean Water Act.
You're right. And then it, you'd always find out, you know, whether it's 10 years later, 20, oops, we didn't know about this. Or
but in fracking, we do know how bad it is. There's no instance in which it doesn't pollute the aquifers and then the air and the public, and it's just not necessary.
Mm-hmm.
So it bothers me a great deal that this is going on and that there's some quiet sort of movement towards doing it, even though there's no study to prove that it can be done safely. And so I raised the specter with an attorney off air one day. I said, and on air I've mentioned that, why isn't this reckless endangerment?
Yeah.
When you know the outcome of what you're doing poisons people, that the chemicals are bad for the water, they're bad for the wild. I mean, there's just nothing good about it.
Right.
Why is that not reckless endangerment?
I mean, I have to say, I agree with everything you're saying, but of all the governors that we've had, and Martin O'Malley seems to be, in a lot of ways, the closest to an environmentalist. And if anybody's going to come up with an adequate study, I would hope it would be his administration. You know, we've tried to push the federal government as well, the EPA, to do it. We failed. The Obama administration has not come through.
They've been terrible. I said, boy, I voted twice for Obama, and boy, they have just done nothing positive along these lines with the environment. Well, when you look at global warming, if you don't mind, if we switch a little bit here, Tom, how is that showing up in the Bay?
Well, I mean, you can see it already. Of course, the Bay is, especially the Eastern Shore, what we call the Eastern Shore, has for decades already been experiencing the Earth sinking, and that's a natural phenomena. But combined with sea rise, you can go down to a place like Dorchester County, and you can see the results. You can see in a place like Blackwater Wildlife Refuge that the wetlands are disappearing, and they have sort of time sequence photographs down there, you know, every couple of years. You can visually see these wetlands disappearing. You can sort of take a kayak trip there, and you can see, like, a whole riverbank full of these dead trees where, you know, the salt from the rising water is just killing these trees. I mean, it's visible. You can see little tiny islands just disappearing that once were inhabited, even. Down on Tangier Island, right on the border of Virginia, they're really panicking now. They need a seawall because, you know, when you have these storm surges with the increased volume, the bigger seas, they're threatened. But, you know, it's not going to be that long before you're going to see it in places like Annapolis, which already floods on a high tide.
Yeah, Baltimore City.
Yeah, Baltimore City. They've done all kinds of studies on what this means. I think they've said expect like a two feet of increased water in the next by the end of this century.
I think it'll be more than that. I think that's a very mild interpretation of what's going on on the planet. But there is a Chesapeake Bay Clean Water Blueprint.
That's what I was talking about before, this idea of finishing the job of reducing pollution. So that's reducing nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment. It's not going to do anything for sea rise. It's not going to necessarily stop population growth, which is a huge other force acting on the Bay. It's not going to by itself do anything to stop the air pollution that's affecting the Bay. A third of the nitrogen is coming from our cars and our coal plants, and for that we're sort of looking to the federal government again for help, you know, other states, Midwestern states with their coal plants. So there's these gigantic forces other than just these three pollutants, but we're doing what we can there.
Well, and fishing, you know, and crabbing and oystering is such a big part of our industry in Maryland. And I know that there's, at least according to the oystermen, there's some sort of good news going on there.
Sure. I mean, I'd say over the last 4 years, the crab population has really rebounded, and that was largely due to the governors of Maryland and Virginia finally agreeing to reducing harvest catch, especially of females. You know, the average person would say, well, duh, I mean,
right.
Save the moms, you know, right?
Uh-huh.
And so these men, politicians, finally did that. And what do you know? The population surged. Now, this year, crabs have fallen back. It's a combination of there's the grasses that the young ones hide in have had a rough year because of the weather. There seems to be a lot of predation from rockfish who are really starving in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have as many, you know, menhaden or whatever, so they're eating those little crabs. So this has not been a great year for the watermen and crabs, but the scientists say that it will pick up. The general trend is really positive for crabs. And oysters themselves, we finally have some good news. I mean, these guys are, you know, still at really rock-bottom population levels, but they're seeing that these diseases that wiped them out in the 80s, they're finally developing resistance to that. And the states are finally setting aside what they call these sanctuary reefs where there can't be any harvesting, supposedly. And so, you know, the oysters actually have a chance to really grow. So there's definitely positive signs, but, you know, the oyster is sort of it's amazing. People, of all the things that we try to get people interested in, oysters, these little ugly, rocky-looking things have a fascination for everybody. And so the good news is even they seem to be turning a corner.
Good. Well, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll look at some of the other issues and what individual householders can do and what might be coming up in the legislative year, because we may not talk again since mm-hmm. before that, and I want to be sure to give the audience a heads up. We'll be right back, and don't forget you can participate in the Chesapeake Bay Foundation's work in many ways. Go to their website at www.cbf.org. That's cbf.org. You can also call them at 1-888 Save Bay, 1-888 Save Bay.
Hi, this is Jorge Aguilar. I'm the Southern Region Director for Food and Water Watch. You can find us at www.foodandwaterwatch.org. And you are listening to Dr. Zohar Hieronymus on 21st Century Radio.
Jose says his name so much better than I ever could. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. By the way, folks, I wanted to let you know my new book is out, The Future of Human Experience, Visionary Thinkers on the Science of Consciousness. It's a Destiny Books 2013 release, and you can find it at your local bookstore, or you can find it at my website, ZoharaOnline.com. And as you would expect, The Future of Human Experience is an integration of the thousands of interviews I've done focused on about 100 or so or more guests, and what everyone finally decides is the wild card is human consciousness, that once we understand the power of consciousness, ours, the animal species, the elements of nature, etc., that in fact will put us in a better course to preserve and restore the earth. So get a copy, The Future of Human Experience, Visionary Thinkers on the Science of Consciousness. And if you buy one from me through the website, I will autograph it for you. If you're just joining us, Tom Zolper joins us, and he is joining us from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. He is the Maryland Communications Coordinator. So, Tom, there were a few things left that I wanted to ask you about. One was the legislative season. Is there anything in particular you all will be working on?
I think we're going to be playing defense, to tell you the truth, though. This, you mentioned earlier, the so-called rain tax, and
yeah.
It's been really controversial, and there's been a number of legislators that have already said we're going to try to overturn this thing. And, you know, our position is there has to be some money to do the job. If there's another way to get this money, great. We think sometimes that having that responsibility locally is a good thing. If you're just getting a check from Annapolis every year, you know, how important is this issue? But if it's coming out of your constituency's pocket, maybe that means something. But however that we can get some funding to attack this job, great. There's going to be a real push to get this thing overturned. We're going to be in there saying, look, find the funding somehow. And that's sort of the battle every year now. A lot of it's going to be over funding as we try to finish this job. As I mentioned before, one of the challenges is cost. and everybody is pinched. We realize that there's a lot of other priorities for our dollar. So it's going to be a battle to make sure that the bay is heard, you know, sort of above the din of roads and, you know, rising gas taxes and you name it. So the battle over money will continue next year. Stay tuned.
There are always so many issues. There was a year that I actually read on the air when I was a daily host every legislative bill title in the legislature, and I proposed that a legislator be limited to not more than introducing one bill a year. And I thought that it makes total sense. Everybody should have a focused priority.
There you go.
So that we could actually, you know, accomplish something in an intelligent way rather than 3,000 amendments that nobody reads attached onto a bill that has nothing to do with the amendment.
Exactly.
Anyway,
or maybe even 3,000 bills.
It's amazing. It's just amazing. So there are other things that the audience can get involved in their own community. I know if you're on waterfront, planting grasses has been helpful. You all have done tremendous amounts of stream cleanups. What other kinds of things can the audience who has an interest in the state's welfare do to help with the bay?
Well, of course, you can start just around, you know, your own house. We ask people, please pick up after your dog. And it seems such a nuisance to do that. I've been there without my bag. But you'd be amazed that there's been studies showing that in some of the creeks in our state, a quarter, a third, even half of the pollution is coming from dog waste. Mm-hmm. Obviously, creeks in heavily urban or suburban areas, and there's other studies that say about half of us don't pick up after our pet. So it does make a huge difference that one dog turd, excuse the color language, it has a lot of bacteria in it, and it goes straight to where your kids. It's swimming. If you can reduce the amount of fertilizer you put on your lawn or do without it altogether, that's great. If you can't, at least find out, you know, when's the best time to put it on. Don't put it on, you know, after sort of November. There's no point to that. If you're able to, you know, put a rain barrel on your house, and for people who aren't familiar, maybe many of your listeners are, but normally the water will gush down the drain pipe straight into the street, down the storm drain, and into your local creek. If you can slow that process down any way, that is really helpful. You as a homeowner can do that. You as a business can do that. You put these little barrels below the drain on your house. You can, you know, hold that water for a while, use it for watering your garden or whatever. It helps a whole lot. But beyond that, you can volunteer. Gosh, CBS has, you mentioned the underwater grass planting, but, if you actually have waterfront property, instead of building that hard riprap or whatever to stop the erosion, we encourage people to vegetate natural native grasses there. It's a lot better, actually, for the erosion, much better for the runoff pollution. You can get involved in growing oysters if you're anywhere near water. We have, and Maryland has, DNR has a huge program where once a year they'll give you these larvae, an old shell of oyster. You put them in this cage, you hang it off, you know, your dock or whatever, and within 8 or 9 months you have baby oysters growing on there, and then they can be taken out and planted with the big guys. There's just so many things you can do. You can help go out to a farm and plant trees along a creek where the guy has finally put his cows back on a pasture, and you want to make sure the manure doesn't make it into the creek. All kinds of volunteer activities. Drive less, you know. We talked about the pollution coming from the air. If there's any way to carpool.
And then I add fly less.
Fly less.
I remember doing stories on the amount of pollution from a single airplane idling on the runway versus all the cars that go into the dynamometer. Those were years ago, but it's an extraordinarily unregulated part of our air pollution.
I didn't know that.
Well, it may have changed since 10 years ago, but the last 10 years ago when I looked, it wasn't highly regulated.
It may not have changed.
That and chemtrails, whatever that is that they're spraying in the air, comes down into the water, and I have no idea, nor do many people, other than there's a lot of aluminum in it.
Mm.
So I don't know what that's doing. But, you know, when you look at this, Tom, mm-hmm. I don't know how long have you worked with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation?
I've been here about 6 years.
And before that, what did you do?
I was a reporter for many years, and then I was also a school teacher. So at CBF, I do sort of a mix. I talk to reporters a lot as the media person, but I also help our very large education department, and they are trying to reach the kids and the teachers and the principals and get them out having Bay experiences.
So you would think that Maryland is such a unique ecosystem that we could be of service to other parts of the world that are struggling with some of the same issues. Have we been successful in certain areas that we have actually been a model?
Sure. I mean, I just was at a conference 2 weeks ago in Baltimore. There were representatives from, Rio de Janeiro is on a huge bay. I want to make sure I say it right. Guadabara Bay, I think it's called. And we think we have it bad. There's so much poverty that a lot of the sewage is untreated and goes directly into the bay. And there's, they're sort of 30 years behind in terms of industrial pollution. So they were coming to us, not just to Chesapeake Bay Foundation, but to the Chesapeake Bay to look at, what have you guys done with sewage pollution? What have you done with runoff? And, yes, we are looked at as the model in a lot of respects. They say that there's more science that has gone into figuring out what's going on in the Chesapeake Bay and how to fix it than any other water body in the world.
Hmm.
So absolutely, this is sort of like the Petri dish for, so many other water bodies. Great lake.
And are there parts of the world where we can look to them as an example? Because I remember the Scandinavian countries were always so much more ahead because of the mm-hmm. body of water that they're surrounded by.
Yeah, I imagine, the technologies that are going to help are going to come from all over the place. This whole idea of runoff being so expensive, and they are now, these sort of landscape engineers are coming up with all inventive ways to design cheap little mini what you would look to be gardens. We call them rain gardens, and around the world they're monkeying around with the design of these things. And that's just one example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I've often wondered why there isn't large-scale hydroponic platforms
mm-hmm.
along the shores. I mean, it seems like such an easy, obvious way to grow food without soil, using water that's plentiful, and also it would help purify it, perhaps.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we can only hope that, the scale, we can upscale some of those things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even down in the Inner Harbor, you'll see that there's some floating wetlands, man-made floating wetlands. That's another sort of innovation that they're devising. But again, it's the scale that you need to sort of make a difference, and, how helpful that would be if we could scale up some of that stuff.
Well, I noticed that on your website, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation has a buffer bonus program to help farmers improve water quality.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Nature has its own technology, and those are trees and the native plants. And, we haven't found anything almost better than plant a tree along a stream on a farm to help suck up that pollution before it gets into the creek. It does help to keep your cows out of the creek with a good old-fashioned fence, but that's what that program is about, a buffer meaning trees and plants.
And it's also lovely what you all do from the Claggett Farm, your farm. For 20 years, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation's Claggett Farm has provided free, fresh produce to people living in poverty and near poverty in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and thanks to the folks who are part of our CSA, that's You as a person who wants fresh vegetables can buy a share of Claggett Farm, and then once a week go down and get your share. We've priced those shares just a little bit higher maybe than some CSAs, so we can use that extra money to take about 40% of the vegetables and for free distribute them, to the needy in Washington, D.C. But really that's possible because of those folks who were paying a little bit more for their share. So
that's lovely.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I've always appreciated about the Chesapeake Bay Foundation is that you file friends of the court briefs and related environmental lawsuits, and I was hoping you might be involved in one or two right now you could tell us about.
Yeah, we always seem to be involved in some, and we say it's the last resort litigation, but it's necessary sometimes. I mean, I guess the biggest one for us in the past couple of years is 2009. We actually sued the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, and it was over this sort of stall in the whole restoration effort. And the Clean Water Act very clearly spelled out that this bay and all the water in the United States had to be swimmable and fishable. And there had been all these sort of voluntary agreements, well, okay, we're going to do it by 2000 or 2010, and it just didn't happen. And so finally, and the responsibility of the government was clear. And so we took the EPA to court, and we, along with some watermen, Bernie Fowler, you know, former state senator from down in southern Maryland, and I hope as at least partly as a result of that effort, this whole, what you referred to earlier as the blueprint, was formed, or sometimes the EPA calls it the pollution diet.
Can you back up for a second, though?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because the failure of the EPA to enforce the Clean Water and Clean Air Act is why we have such terrible situations we have, whether it's with old coal plants or new industries. So
yeah.
What happened as a result of that? Was the EPA found in any way culpable for violation of the law?
They weren't. We ended up doing a sort of conditional settlement, in which we said, what we really want more than anything is a clean bay. And we're going to pull this lawsuit to the side. And as long as we see that you're following through on everything you're promising, and I sort of ticked those off before in terms of setting concrete limits of pollution, holding the states accountable, checking in every 2 years, as long as we see you're doing these things, we're going to hold this lawsuit to the side. So there wasn't any decision by a court.
It just so it sounds, I'm sorry to say this, so ass backwards. The EPA is the one that's supposed to be enforcing the law for the standards of clean water and clean air. And here we have a nonprofit foundation holding the EPA to the standards they're supposed to uphold. It just makes no sense.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, here you had a lawsuit and the EPA gets off the hook. And basically we're saying to the EPA, you all said to the EPA or the court said to the EPA, now if you all do your job and we meet these standards for the Chesapeake Bay... It's fascinating.
Right.
I mean, I've never found a court case yet that has been able to sort of, you know, put the lion back where it belongs.
Yeah, I can't disagree.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think about my notion of this reckless endangerment for some of these issues? Because I read some papers by one of the Georgetown attorneys who has been raising that about the public trust for the air. And I see no reason why not the water. I mean, why is a federal agency or a state government able to do things that we know are endangering the life of the citizenry and themselves, by the way?
Mm-hmm. Yikes. I'm going to have to plead ignorant on this. I mean, this is a legal question, which I guess I'm not familiar enough with. So it would be a suit actually alleging...
For instance, that GMOs, as an example, or fracking, is an instance of reckless endangerment, which is basically a terminology used for a person or a corporation that does something knowingly that it will cause harm.
Okay.
So we know that these things cause harm, whether it's the animal population, the ecosystem, or humans. And nobody yet has done that. And I have said now to a number of activists in other states that what if every state were to go forward with this reckless endangerment, because it's the clearest legal terminology if it were applied to an individual. Like if I baked a cake and I filled it with arsenic and I knew it and I didn't tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, firstly, that would be another. That's not a good example, but you understand what I'm saying.
Sure. And I guess the government being responsible. For,
exactly.
Right.
They are responsible as a public trust for our air, our water, our shared resources, our land.
Right.
And when they don't do things to prevent certain things or they do things to enable certain things, I don't see why it's not reckless endangerment. So I'm going to put that, pitch that into your net.
All right.
Take that back to the organization.
I'm going to take it back to the litigators.
Yes, exactly, and see if that can't add some a little bite to these court cases, because
sure.
These court cases are so expensive, and I've seen activists in states do this, and it just doesn't produce the outcomes we need. But I thank you, Tom, and all the work that you all do at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. We have about a minute left. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us?
No, I just want to thank everybody else who is making an effort. It's not just one organization. It's everybody. And we've reached that stage where I really do mean that, not as just sort of a platitude, but the most inspiring thing to me is to go out, whatever it is, 40 years after this whole thing started, you have little organizations watching over the smallest little creeks, and they're testing the water and they're putting in rain gardens and they're, doing stream cleanups. And to me, that ultimately is what's going to get the job done, because there'll be enough people who care and will be incensed, if that sewage plant spills or, like you say, the fracking, pollutes. And that's what you need in activism. You need an army of people who care. And so to that army, I say thank you.
Absolutely. Again, you can learn more at their website. I encourage you to. You can learn where you can volunteer, how you can help. Go to www.cbf.org. You can also call them at 1-888-SAVE-BAY. That's 1-888-SAVE-BAY. You can buy a Chesapeake Bay license plate. You can do a lot of things. Thank you very much, Tom, for being with us.
Thank you, Zoe.
You'll have more.
Stimulating talk around the clock. And breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Paul Stevens.